Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Welcome to DW's Africa Link program, coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet. Do remember, we are also live on Facebook, DW Africa, so do join the conversation. And coming up on the program, leaders from West Africa's regional bloc, ECOWAS, meet in Abuja to discuss and resolve the ongoing conflict between herdsmen and farmers. We hear from an analyst why it has taken long to resolve the crisis.
The regional club have to take a coordinated collective approach as opposed to one of the individual states, particularly in Nigeria, to not simply do it.
And South Sudan peace talks taking place under the auspices of the Intergovernmental Agreement on Development, IGAD, failed to kick off, raising fears of further escalation of violence between warring factions.
IGAD will never bring peace to this country. Except ourselves as South Sudanese, we can sit down and negotiate our own problem, because this problem is our problem. It's not the outsider problem. It's not IGAD problem. It's South Sudanese problem.
Well, these are some of the stories that we've planned for you.
But first, here is a chance to listen to what's happening around the world.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. A top advisor to Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has said Tehran would not accept any amendments to its nuclear deal. This was after French President Emmanuel Macron discussed a possible new deal with U.S. President Donald Trump during his Wednesday visit to Washington. Trump has maintained that he would refuse to extend U.S. sanction relief on Iran if Europe doesn't fix the so-called flawed deal by May 12th. Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova said there can be no changes.
We are seriously concerned by all of this. I am referring to comments made by the presidents of the United States and France about the Iran nuclear program. Russia has repeatedly said that there is no possibility for some kind of revote, change, or enlargement of this deal.
The deal was made in 2015 between Iran, the U.S., the U.K., France, Germany, China, and Russia. South Korea has held a press briefing ahead of Friday's historic inter-Korean summit, the third such meeting since the Korean War started in 1950. During the briefing, Seoul said North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in have agreed to meet before the summit at a village just north of the demilitarized zone that divides the peninsula. Talks are expected to focus on North Korea's nuclear program and peace on the peninsula. The African Union and the UN Human Rights Office held high-level talks in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa on Thursday. During the meeting, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Al-Hussein, said both organizations need to work together.
The African Union is a mighty force, and I'm convinced that we are natural allies. I call on you to help us stand for the rights of all women and men, not only on this continent, but across the world.
This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. A UN official said Thursday that 10 South Sudanese aid workers have gone missing in South Sudan. Their convoy is believed to have been intercepted in the central Equatorial region. The UN has demanded the immediate release of the aid workers and has called on all parties in South Sudan to assist with their safe return. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, UN investigators have found five suspected mass graves in the country's eastern Ituri province, where at least 260 people have died since December due to ethnic violence. Investigators did not provide details about the graves, but said more than 100 towns were destroyed in violent flare-ups since late last year. And finally, Ukraine has marked 32 years since the Chernobyl nuclear power plant explosion. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko said the world's worst nuclear disaster will always remain an open wound in the heart of Ukraine and in the hearts of millions of people. The explosion killed an estimated 4,000 people and forced hundreds of thousands to evacuate. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
You're listening to DW's Africa Link program with me, Jane Ayeko-Kumet.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe, and we'd like to welcome our fans on Facebook, like Emmanuel Awule, who says he's listening live from Ghana. We begin the program in Nigeria, where leaders from the Economic Community for West African States, ECOWAS, have been meeting in the capital, Abuja, to adopt a coordinated regional approach in addressing the escalation of cases of conflicts between herders and farmers. Violence between the two groups has threatened stability in central states, despite promises from President Muhammadu Buhari's administration to bring it to an end. Before we came on air, I spoke to Junaidu Mohammed, a politician and former member of parliament in Nigeria, and I started by asking him why it had to take the regional bloc ECOWAS to resolve the crisis. Take a listen.
The regional club have to take a coordinated collective approach. As opposed to one of the individual states, particularly Nigeria, could not simply do it. And even if they tried to do it sincerely, which is denied, I don't believe they could have succeeded. It has also acquired some of the other issues which have bedeviled Nigerian politics, namely religious and ethnic coloring. And these issues are not likely to be resolved, or any other issue is not likely to be resolved by simply playing politics with it.
Critics of Buhari say he has done little or nothing to stop the violence because the herders are his kinsmen from the mainly Muslim north of the country. Is this a fair assessment?
No, it's not a fair assessment. Not because Buhari has done anything worthy of being praised, but because those who assume the herders, who are mostly Fulanese, and then therefore they want to fight Buhari politically. Buhari is not a Fulani man. And they are not northerners because most of us who are either Fulanis or who are northerners don't know this kind of Fulanis. And the issue of herders fighting farmers is not beginning with Buhari or with Jonathan or with Yaradua. And a number of those such Fulanis who are the kind you could identify with, because if you spoke fully their language, you could understand them. The current Fulanis of today are simply a different breed. I don't know where they are coming from. But then nobody should be surprised with that, because out of the 54 countries in the EU today, which make the overwhelming number of the countries in the African continent, 33 have identified Fulani settlements or Fulani towns.
Junaidu Mohammed, a politician and former member of parliament in Nigeria. And Jane, we have lots of comments, but first let's appreciate those following us live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Ahmed Buba says he is listening live from Adamawa Mobe in Nigeria. Thanks, Ahmed.
And right away to the comments, King Osho is saying Nigeria is now turning into a death zone like Central African Republic. That's his assessment of the situation.
And Ektu too says they'd come up with some solution before the border becomes irrelevant. And so is Felix Oroko says, DW, it is not a clash between farmers and Fulani herdsmen. It's an attack by Fulani herdsmen.
Un Uchemadu says Buhari told the world that Gaddafi's boys and that it was Gaddafi's boys, and yet he refused to declare them as terrorists. None of them is being arrested. They kill as they like and go without trace, and you call them farmers or herdsmen. God is watching. Well, that's his observation. Those are not DW comments, but rather comments from our followers. And you too have the chance to join the conversation by checking out our Facebook page, DW Africa. In the world scene, German Chancellor Angela Merkel travels to Washington tomorrow, Friday, to meet US President Donald Trump. Her visit comes after that of French President Emmanuel Macron. Apart from trade, the two leaders will also discuss the issue of Iran's nuclear power program. Unlike Macron, who seems to get along with Trump, pragmatic Merkel has failed to establish as a strong rapport with Trump, but both Merkel and Trump are urging the US not to abandon the multinational Iran nuclear deal. Now, Macron's flatter combined with critique or Merkel's pragmatic diplomacy, whose strategy will work? This is a question DW's Amrita Shima put to our political correspondent, Peter Craven. Take a listen.
Yeah, well, we'll have to wait and see, because Merkel hasn't arrived yet. But my bet is that neither of them are going to prove effective on the two key issues of the moment. That's the Iran nuclear deal, which the US is threatening to walk away from in just less than 2 weeks' time. And then there's the question of whether the US is going to impose punitive tariffs on the EU on imports from the EU of steel and aluminium. And it certainly looks as though the US is going to do that. So on neither of those critical issues is the US going to budge. And whether the this is a good cop, bad cop operation between Macron and Merkel, we don't know. But I don't think it's going to prove very effective on those two issues.
Some people are talking about this being a diplomatic strategy from the Europeans. You know, you have Macron going there, softening up Trump, and then you have Merkel who comes with her own kind of approach. Do you think that will be effective in any way?
Well, the one hope we can have, I mean, if we look at the track record of Angela Merkel's track, she's been in office for 12 years. In that time, she's struck up a very warm relationship with George W. Bush, a very warm relationship with President Obama. She is a person who has a great sense of humour and a lot of sort of... She likes people. She's a people person. It's very masked with Angela Merkel, but anybody who knows her from private settings, even private settings between politicians, they say she can get on with people, she can strike up relationships with people, and maybe she will just yet strike up a relationship with Donald Trump.
DW's political correspondent Peter Craven.
And we apologize for the sound quality there. And back to Africa. The resumption of South Sudan peace talks in Addis Ababa failed to take off this Thursday after rival parties in South Sudan drew tough lines, including the demand for the immediate resignation of President Salva Kiir. There are, however, no indications that the Juba government would accept that the president steps down at the first stage of a political transition.
Now, South Sudan's peace talks are being pushed by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, and the African Union. We now cross over to James Shimanyula in Nairobi, who is closely following developments on the peace talks.
It is now official. The on and off peace talks aimed at reviving South Sudan peace agreement, which collapsed in 2015, will take place on the 3rd of May in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. The postponement was confirmed by IGAD communications officer Mohamed Ahmed Abdullahi when he spoke to me by telephone from Djibouti, the headquarters of the East African Regional Trade Bloc that has been mediating the fighting factions in South Sudan.
We are postponing it again. As far as I know, there is a high-level revitalization forum for South Sudan to start on the 3rd of May.
The revitalization forum that Abdullahi is referring to is the IGAD forum responsible for ensuring that the 2015 peace agreement is revived. Speaking at a funeral ceremony for South Sudan fallen Army Chief James Mawut, President Kiir wondered why Riek Machar and representatives of opposition groups have brought up the issue of his resignation when it has never been highlighted in 9 past sessions of peace talks. South Sudan Minister for Cabinet Affairs, Elia Lamoro, pleaded with the parties involved in the peace talks to focus on the success of discussion and avoid rhetorical political issues.
We are insisting that this time everybody must be told to focus and conform to the objectives. So we want to be very clear that we are not shying away from our commitment to the agreement.
Ordinary South Sudanese, too, have raised their concerns on resumption of peace talks next month.
Let them look into the suffering of the people of South Sudan. But if they continue to look on the position whereby I want to be the president, I want to be this, we will never get this peace. The peace is failing because we are seeing the chairs are the most important.
IGAD will never, never bring peace to this country. Except ourselves as South Sudanese, we can sit down and negotiate our own problem because this problem is our problem. It's not the outsider problem. It's not IGAD problem. It's South Sudanese problem.
It is a report by James Shimanyula. And the people out there, Isaac, are saying it is a problem, it's a national problem, and they should be the ones responsible in resolving it.
Exactly. They want to come up with homemade solutions rather than these intergovernmental bodies, you know, to meddle in the politics. And we have some comments, Jane, about the story, don't we?
Yeah. Khalifa Abdulrahim says those who led the war are unfit to build the country. There are many South Sudanese elites who are capable of navigating the country into peace and stability. The chance has to be given to the well-educated and open-minded leaders. That's what Khalifa says.
And an interesting comment from one of our followers, Tata Prince. He says, they are all confused and power hungry. He's talking about the President Salva Kiir and, of course, the rebel leader Riek Machar, who and the other 11 parties who are insisting that the president steps down first before they can resume the talks.
It's quite interesting to see how things develop with the IGAD intervention in there, the African Union, and then the other people also saying it should be solved at a local level. Well, you have the chance to join the conversation and share your opinion with us by joining the conversation on DW Facebook page, DW Africa.
And just to remind you, of course, you know, the listener out there, Jen, our correspondent, James Shimanyula, is up and awake, you know, following up on this story whenever it breaks down and of any developments. So we'll keep following this story and we'll bring it to you whenever we can. Stay tuned. And in case you've just tuned in, you're listening to DW's Africa Link program coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet. And in the next 15 minutes, we shall be hearing about Ugandan doctors who have threatened to strike over a government plan to hire Cuban doctors who will receive a higher pay compared to their Ugandan counterparts.
This Cuban solution undermines the Buy Uganda, Build Uganda policy, and it threatens our progress with the state. Already some doctors are talking about industrial action.
Also coming up in our usual U-Zone segment, a segment that focuses on issues relating to the youth, we will be hearing how Ghana's makeup industry is on the rise. So just stay with us, don't go away, and listen how the young ladies there are trying to beautify themselves, isn't it, Jane?
Yes, they're trying to beautify themselves. But let's first talk about matters of health. Now, on Wednesday, we reported about Kenyan unemployed doctors crying foul after the government decided to go forward with a controversial plan to hire medics from Cuba. Now, the Ugandan government wants to do the same. The plan has faced severe resistance after it emerged that they would be paid better than the local medical personnel who are now demanding for equal pay. The Ugandan government finally admitted to reports that they had contacted the Cuban government to provide doctors to replace the Ugandans who are threatening to take industrial action again. Alex Gita in Kampala brings us that report.
Government plans to bring in at least 200 doctors from Cuba to fill up vacancies in rural areas.
Idea is to provide manpower, skilled manpower, at maybe consultancy level, in our regional referral hospitals, particularly those referral hospitals which have failed to attract consultants.
That was Uganda's Minister for Public Service, Mururi Mukasa, defending the move. But the doctors are not happy. They say they only demanded for better working conditions and would work anywhere in the country. Members of parliament are also opposed to the plan, but demanded that the Cuban doctors could be used to train more local medical personnel. MPs Dr. Michael Bukenya and Sevikali Joel, both from the ruling NRM party, are some of the members against this move.
We don't agree to that proposal unless if they are bringing specialists in areas where we are challenged, like ENT surgeons, but for instance, gynecologists, surgeons, physicians, pediatricians, we have plenty of those in the country.
When you bring Cubans, they are very expensive. The only way we can build Uganda is to make sure that these technocrats can come to our universities, train our students as lecturers, and we build Uganda for sustainability.
Minister for Health, Sarah Opendi, said that the government is moving fast to counter threats by the Ugandan doctors who threatened industrial action if their salaries are not increased. This was confirmed by Finance Minister Matia Kasaija.
The doctors were threatening to strike, and some of them were asking terms which this economy cannot afford. So therefore we said, if our doctors really should decide to go on strike, we can't have these hospitals without personnel. You know the consequence.
Government promised to increase doctors' salaries from 1.4 million to 3 million Uganda shillings, which is about $800. If the Cuban doctors are hired, government plans to pay them $1,500, a disparity that got the doctors talking. Dr. Ekwaro Ebuku is the chairperson of the Uganda Medical Association.
If they are bringing 200 Cuban doctors, let government advertise 200 posts for specialist doctors with those terms that they are giving the Cubans, that it is 5.4 million. This Cuban solution undermines the Buy Uganda, Build Uganda policy, and it threatens our progress with the state. Already some doctors are talking about industrial action, and we are telling them it's not yet time.
Kenya has the same plan. So why are the two East African countries going for Cuban doctors? A question I put to Uganda's Minister of Health, Sarah Opendi.
A decision was reached that we reach out to the Cubans because they do export a number of doctors to come and work in the regional facilities.
A report by Alex Gita in the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
And of course, as you've just heard him, a question he put to the Ugandan minister, and so did we put a similar question to on our Facebook page, W Africa. But first of all, we said, just like Kenya, there are mass protests in these countries in opposition to it. So why doesn't the government of Uganda and Kenya rather invest in local doctors rather than importing foreign doctors? And we have lots and lots of comments, but we'll read just a few for the sake of time. Masaba Putin, I like the name anyway, says the doctors who are coming from Cuba are going to help us empower our local doctors through job training. No doctor is going to lose his job because of the island doctors.
And somebody who goes by the name Tata Prince, are they coming with drugs or other medical equipment which we don't have? It's a question there.
Jalo Lamin says, oh, I thought it's only the Gambia that imports doctors daily as commodities. Or Africa, should my coordinate always rely on importation?
I can't hesitate to read one from Bernard Mujeni, who says, how are Cuban doctors going to communicate with the locals since most of the nationals don't speak English and other international languages? And one coming in from Simeon says, when Cuba was training their doctors, where was Uganda? Interesting comments there. You too can join the conversation. Just go to DW Facebook page, DW Africa.
Speaking out. Now, the UN Human Rights Chief says he has witnessed tremendous hope but also anxiety in Ethiopia on his latest visit, less than a month after the country installed a new prime minister who was promised reforms. UN Human Rights Chief Zaid Raad Al Husseini said he was able to visit the restive Oromia region at the heart of months of anti-government protests and met privately with people recently released from detention. DW's Mel Gabula from the Amharic Service spoke to Al Husseini about his visit to the Oromia and Amhara regions.
It was an extremely interesting visit. We wanted, first of all, and we asked for access, and this is an issue that goes back to my previous visit, and before that even, that we needed, as an office, we needed access to Oromia and Amhara. And when the new prime minister took office, we were given that access to Oromia. If I had more time, I would have also pushed to go to Amhara. It afforded me an opportunity to listen to a great many people. Now, in Oromia, I met with the Abagadash, the tribal leaders, mm-hmm. The traditional leaders. And they were very forthright in their views. I was surprised because we had government representatives with us, but it didn't prevent the traditional leaders from speaking out. They voiced in one way their admiration and optimism given what the Prime Minister had said in his inaugural speech before the People's Assembly, and it was a speech that very much conformed with many of the things that we would say as a human rights office with the UN.
What are the major cases that probably you understood or heard from these people that you've met in these 4 days?
Those who we believed who were arbitrarily arrested in the past, I met them private, many of them. And so we had a very long discussion, or I rather listened to them. Mm-hmm. And clearly, the issue of the heavy-handedness of the security responses, the excessive use of force, the fact that the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission is not a Paris Principles compliant. Mm-hmm. Human Rights Commission. In other words, it's not fully independent. And so even though it conducted investigations of this, there are many who believe that the reports are not independent and convey only one view. And so there was a strong feeling that all of the alleged violations, and some of them, or many of them severe, have to be properly investigated. And then we heard from a number of them that, you know, there has to be judicial reform. You know, there has to be the judiciary has to be independent. It's this sort of tone that was conveyed.
That was the UN Human Rights Chief Zeid Raad Al-Husseini speaking to DW's Mel Gabula from the Amharic Service. There is much more to come. Please don't go away. We'll be back right after this.
Use on.
Yes, our Use On is, of course, a program, or rather the segment in where we feature issues that affect or rather interest the young people. And this time round, it's about makeup. Now, the industry of makeup in northern Ghana hasn't been as vibrant as it is in the south. Most often, makeup artists come from the big cities like Accra or Kumasi to the north to beautify brides and grooms instead of patronizing the local ones. But one young lady has decided to change all that. She operates the Queen's Comfort Beauty Saloon, where she has trained several young women in the business. Now, she's at the forefront of the growth of the beauty industry in northern Ghana, as Maxwell Souk found out when he went to meet her.
Zack Osman Shamsia is getting married today.
Yes, I'm very happy. I'm thanking God for bringing me this far.
Here in the north, trends come a little later, but now most better of brides expect to hire a makeup artist for their wedding because everyone wants to look their best on their big day.
I wanted to look different. People have been seeing my face every day, so they should see something extraordinarily different.
Mustafa Elham is her makeup artist. She came all the way from Accra to make up Shamsia for her wedding.
I'm only adding more beauty to her looks. Her own lips is natural, but I've given her a different color. Today is a special day for her, and she has to look more beautiful.
For quite a long time, the North has lacked good makeup artists, and people still fly in beauticians from the south of Ghana to do bridal makeup. But more young people are learning to become makeup artists in the North too now.
So you see her skin tone, yeah, with the face. She is not dark and she's not fair.
Okay.
So you see the foundations. This foundation is dark,
yeah,
and this foundation is a little bit fair.
Yeah.
So we just want to create a tone.
The Queen's Comfort Beauty Saloon in Tamale has been one of the places that trains young makeup artists in the northern region. The owner of the beauty saloon is 26-year-old Moro Dufier.
Where we do makeup, hair fixing, we train young girls and upcoming girls who want to also enter the beauty industry. So basically, this is what Queen's Comfort Saloon is about.
Her beauty saloon is barely 2 years old, but several young people have already turned up to be trained as makeup artists. She says there's huge potential in the sector.
So makeup is like worldwide now. There's a great opportunity and people, and there's room for everyone. That's what I would say. Like, it doesn't matter where you are. If there are hundreds of people, you still get your clientele. Like,
Moro Dufier actually studied biological sciences, but she has put her studies on hold to grow her makeup business. She developed an interest in the beauty business by watching tutorials on YouTube.
But when I wanted to enhance it, I went to a makeup artist called Munaya. She's in Accra. I liked the way she did her makeup, so I just wanted to know why hers is different from mine.
Despite the challenges, the up-and-coming makeup artists of Northern Ghana are working hard to catch up with those in the south.
Maxwell Souk with that report on beauty, makeup in northern Ghana.
And it seems the makeup business is booming in Ghana, as you've heard in that report, and other African countries. Jen, we asked, why do people wear makeup and why does it seem most can't do without it? And we asked all our fans to join the debate. Very quickly, I'm anxious to read this one on our Facebook page from Obobo Odmani. Says, the purpose is to hide flaws which are caused or worsened by these same makeups. Mm-hmm. And Abu Odman says, again, people, not only Africans, he says, DW, not only Africans are victims of cosmetics industry hype. Many are.
Vag Breno says, I believe most African ladies are not satisfied with their present form, so they find it interesting to change their looks. Isaac, you are a man. Many women say they wear makeup to look beautiful for the men to see them. Do you agree with that?
Beautifies in the eyes of the beholder, I guess. And of course, with makeup, I think I can tolerate that, but not bleaching. Is it what we covered recently?
Yes.
Yeah. But like I said, I repeat this. Beauty lies in the eyes of the beholder. Many thanks for those comments. And of course, you can still join the debate by commenting on our stories. Our Facebook page is DW Africa. And on behalf of the production crew behind there, I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet. Have a pleasant time.